I should say one of the pleasures I also didn't fully anticipate when I took over this series and Lukacja. I looked first at the list of poets she chose to bring in for the year. I was coming to terms or getting a chance to read the poets on that list who I just simply did not know, either all that well or, I confess, in Rhea's case, not at all. I was told never to say that when I introduce a poet. But I have, because it's been a pleasure in the last week or so, certainly not coming to terms with all of Rhea's work. She has 6 books of poetry, All Souls, with a Signal Edition, came out last year, is her most recent work. She's a children's author, and she's a novelist as well. But as I say, it's been a pleasure to lug All Souls with me, back and forth in the subway, when I'm lucky, back and forth to the pub, and read it. They're lovely poems. I've come to appreciate them more and more as I've read them. I just want to say, I mean, if to venture my one critical remark, the clarity of her poems seem to be almost synonymous with her honesty. They come together in that way. In my experience so far, the difficulty of Tregubov poem is never an understanding what it says, but it's difficult precisely because of what it says. And we're left looking, whether we like it or not, in back at our own lives in a difficult way. So I'm happy that she's here. I'm happy to meet her and happy to hear her read her work. So thank you, Rhea.
Thank you. Oh, talk about a tough act to follow, Carla. That was fantastic. I warned Carmen that I was going to embarrass him in person because I think his ears have been burning for quite a while. Carmen was the editor of All Souls, and my publisher, Simon Dardick, is also here. I'd like to thank both of them for bringing this book to life. Thank Katja and Darren as well for bringing me here to Montreal, which is one of my favorite cities in the world. So it's fabulous to be here. Carmen took this book right away when he read it, which was a great mercy, as all writers know, just to get a quick answer when you're offering a manuscript. And then and told me what he thought was happening in it, which brought my own project into greater clarity, but so importantly made me really believe in this book, because I think I was wavering. And he did this remarkable combination of caring about it so much and believing in it so much and being incredibly demanding of it and not letting anything slip. And I think you've said to me a number of times, Carmen, oh, it was so rough. And it wasn't rough. It was exactly what I wanted. I wanted to make this the best book that I could, and you helped me make it this to such a large degree. And that, this is my, actually, it's my 7th book. That's rare. It's rare in 7 books to get that kind of editor. So thank you so much. Thank you. And I very much love your work, and that was an astonishing reading. So one of the things that Carmen helped me understand in this book is that there is a alternation between what he was calling shard-like poems, which are short and brief and quite sharp, and the longer discursive poems, which from the one that Sue read and talked about, was much more what I was used to. And the shard poems were very interesting to me, but I was afraid to believe in them, but I do now. For better or for worse. So I'll read the opening poem in the Landclim section, which is one of those short poems. And we're at the other side of Solstice now. We're coming into the light. But this is a poem for All Souls Day, which is November 2nd. All Souls Day. Some moon, full and fall. So close it grazes the houses. The clock's gone back now, 6, and it's near dark. That moon, bright though, and the city. Cars, their lights, wash by on pavement made for them. This sidewalk, its dates marked in concrete, 1977, 1992, made for me, by someone. That someone, a soul now, perhaps, body done in earth, winter soon. I'd like to read, this section of the book is called Land Claims, and I know I'm appropriating a term from First Nations, but it seemed to me a good title for this section where I tried to take my concerns, my ecological concerns, which are back in that old, quite an old poem. It was fun to see that connection there still, but trying to take a personal tack on these larger poem issues as well. This one is called Les Temps de Cerise, and there's a bad word in it, but I think I'm safe with this crowd. Actually, you're a scary crowd. You are so smart. God, it's terrifying. And now I'm going to have to speak French. So the title is French, and I do understand a lot of French, but I have a very funny accent. So it's called Le Temps de Cerise, cherry time. Massacre in my kitchen. The counter spatter incarnadine, my hands bloodied with the juice of cherries splayed, gutted for deserted friends. My fingers dyed a red that keeps in the fine creases under the nails through the next day's breakfast, lunch. I tremble to sacrifice none of this, even though the cherries, local, organic, spoke to me, insisting on their innocence, the plump, burgundy wholeness of them. I didn't think to spare them, never do. Not them, nor the shrimp I clean for my son's homecoming dinner, each shrimp life given over, given up to our celebration. Deeper into that same night, I hear through my open window close someone else's baby cry. Such grief, and nothing will ease it. Not the breast or rest or warmth or darkness or light. Nothing will ease it forever and ever or for the long moment till all is well and silent. We can't help ourselves. Who wouldn't trade their own child's comfort for another's harm? Another child's harm. We can't help ourselves, knowing it's wrong, knowing there would be a remedy if we wanted it. Now someone has written a book I won't be reading about how the earth would do without us, rewriting not the past, airbrushing Trotsky out of the Stalin snaps, but the future, a projection sans projecteur. It's getting hotter. We're starting to agree we've fucked it up. The review says the author has visited fresh ruins, a city abandoned only decades, and it's easy to foretell. Bougainvillea purpling rooftops, the small fingers of roots diligently rubbing out difference. No inside, no out. To some, perhaps it's comforting to think of the earth scratching at its ear, good dog, and us no more than fleas in its coat. A good scrub, a sprinkling of powder, and all is well again. None mourning our self-massacre, not the cherries gone wild, the gleeful shrimp gaining all we consumed. He imagines furthermore humpbacks releasing their arias without contest, butterflies sculpting air. I don't want to. Useless though my own life has seemed to me, at times, despite cherries, despite friends. I want this curious project to continue, our certain hunger, our subtleties, our complicated contradictions. The aria is less necessary to me than the way a mouth is held, the look in an eye that engenders them. though my own evaluation of the human is that, as the song goes, you can't have one without the other. Next poem is also a long one. It's called The Gardens of the Antarctic, and in it I imagine what would happen if climate change continued to such a degree that, in fact, the ecosystem of the Antarctic were such that there were gardens. And Carmen looked at the draft, and he said, if it's too long, it's all Carmen's fault, because he said you have to really dig in and create it. And so all the strange creatures that I mention in it are real, and the author's notes at the back explain who they are, and it was really fun Googling them. So, The Gardens of the Antarctic. This is the poem that hasn't been written yet, the one about the garden propagating itself, untended, tinting what was 5 million miles square of white once, green. Not the simple ecosystem of survivors it was, among the stone shoals of moss, thin lawns of hermaphrodite bryophytes, pearlwort thickening to shelter its minute pale yellow trumpet flowers, eking rootlets into the chinks and pores of sandstone and granite. Wingless, eyeless, gregarious, sprightly springtails, not bugs, but dry cousins, perhaps, of shrimp, abounding on scree slopes. Microscopic moss piglets rumbling a slow stroll through lichen. Predatory mites. Not the spare biosphere we have and are unraveling. Remember those elders of the other pole, the 20th century, the seismic intrusion into their consciousness, their landscape of a bumblebee? Next to final notice for that ice. Who will be astounded by the soft rise of what seem like groves drawing from a soil that grew itself from penguin guano, from the crocodile-esque teeth, the thin articulate bones of ice fish? Not yet a canopy of tree ferns, Amazonian bromeliads lodging their small frogs, salamander, snails. No orchids amid kapok trees, stern and sacred, their buttressed trunks 10 feet across, 200 high. No prickly yucca, spiders the size of baseballs. Something we can't quite picture. Something like shrubs, their lonesome angular branches reaching into a blur of sky, vaguely pregnant with dwarf fruit, round, red, the evolutionary echo of a pip that drifted south, bobbed on growlers, the swallowed pith of an ancestor, rounder, redder. What fruit falls among meadows of hair grass, housing the bones of whaling stations, the pink tatting of their bloom frayed, their blades scabbed no longer with indigenous midges, but with alien species. Things that slide, that are swift and ragged. Rusty amid that green and armored. And although they may blossom, may in their own turn alter the air with their breath, though they may be beautiful, this is the poem we won't be here to read, the one we wouldn't wish to. I got to stay, when I was writing the book, I got to stay in the south of France for a while in a beautiful little village perché, just, you know, like 40 buildings or 40 people, called La Bastide d'Esparberonc, France, and that's the title of the poem. Here it is exactly, beauty and decay. Though nothing is exact about this town. Walls as much mountain as wall, crevices sparsely in flower. Dry stone fences marking the fields, wattle fences, their branches laced into the grid of wire. This place makes me think crooked, different from the machined thoughts of the city. Euclid was a dope. Try to calculate the area of that irregular field beyond the rusted railing, the garden rough below the terrace, its order, disorder. A pebble budges. Or the azalea bush, spottily in bloom, one of its bright petals shifting in a bit of wind. The infinite perimeter of this tuft of grass, moss on the rock below, the distance between there and here. Those are from land claims, the first section of the book, and I feels such echoes with Carmen's last poem, because last section of the book is called Family Dinners, and much of it circles around the illness and death of my father at a much, much more advanced age. And I think when we contracted the book, my dad was still alive, right? And I was working through them. And one of the interesting things to do, working through the book of the whole after his death, is that I was allowed to let go of some of the hope that I had to write into the poems. So I'll read just two of these, and then close with a poem that Carmen included in the Best Poetry Anthology that's also from this section. The first is called Family Dinners, Salt and Pepper. The wooden scalloped valance above the kitchen window in the old house, I remember. And that the window itself framed only the white stucco wall of the house next door, sun through it. Grudgingly scrubbing my little sister's baby formula from the ridges in the chrome trim rimming the lime green formica. What I can't recollect is them together at that table. Just my mother moving from counter to fridge to stove, conveying tuna casseroles and meatloaves, spaghetti and meatballs. My father rumbling at her from his chair to sit down and eat. The valence of that orbit, what combining power, attraction, kept them together those years, bringing us up, bringing us to our own lives, marriages, which we planned on being perfect. The scratchy edges of their irritable connection all sanded smooth. Once we were done growing, they became our faintly comic twosome, fitting into each other's modest idiosyncrasies as neatly as the paired cat and dog interlocked in close embrace, the Dutch boy and girl, their pouty lips never and always touching. I know what keeps them now. Now, my father pulls up a chair to empty the dishwasher after it's done, goes down to do the laundry, taking a breather between folds, pulling each heavy woolen sock onto its stretcher. My mother spoons borscht into his bowl, tenders it to the table. He looks up, pats at her hand. It's so good, betraying what they feel still. The two of them, together, eating dinner. And this is, my father was ill with and eventually died of Alzheimer's. So this refers to that aspect of his last years. It's called Family Dinners, Borrowed Time. Those of you who've been in this situation know that one of the tests for Alzheimer's is simply to draw a clock and the numbers on the clock. My father can't draw the hands on the clock, can't draw its face. In his own hand, the pencil falters, rests. I failed the test, he tells us. I look at my hands. We'd like 2 minutes in our living room, Friday at 5, him home and me lifted, solid, safe, beyond myself, into his hold, the feel of that hold. I'd like 10 minutes on a Sunday, January 1959. The length of the toboggan run down the bank of the Red, my mother staying warm in the car, him keeping me in the world between his arms. An hour early June in the backyard on Matheson Avenue, hoeing rows for the yellow beans, the seeds soaked, then pushed a careful forefinger into soil. The time it took the canoe just big enough to keep us, to reach the island. We were okay with him in the stern. Then time for the fire he made of twigs, enough to crisp 5 hot dogs, 1 each, as we watched the light hit the lid of the lake, glance off all it contained. And this is also in the family dinners section, but it's for my son. It's called The New House. You didn't like my new house because I packed your childhood into 2 plastic bins when I moved. And even though I followed you to your new city, I left the old house behind, the one where we both grew up. I packed the photo albums and your kindergarten finger paintings, your baby clothes. I packed the videotape of your 3rd birthday and my 40th. You didn't know I was afraid to pack everything that had been pushed to the back of the closet. Or did you? You always knew everything, knew it often before I did. The way tears came into your eyes but didn't fall when your father and I sang Ode to Joy beside your bed. And I thought everything was okay. I said, everything's okay, didn't I? How could I unpack those days? Remember the family you drew for yourself before things broke. Your happy self and happy wife and happy baby. And now here you are in the middle of your own life, your own house, the wise life you're constructing for yourself, for someone you love, someone who loves you back, with work and friends and food. I like my new house, even though you're not in it often. I want your new life, all the good things you've put in it. Maybe I have one too. What can we do with the old life but make ourselves a better one? Thank you.